Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. Last month, Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick visited Fort Wayne. She spoke at Carroll High School at a Public Schools Week event organized by Charger Advocates from Northwest Allen County Schools. There will be a couple of moments where you'll hear from me again. The superintendent used a PowerPoint, but for the most part did a good job of fully explaining what is on the slides for those of us who do not have the benefit of seeing her presentation. Here's Jennifer McCormick. Please enjoy the show.
It is truly, truly my pleasure to be back in Allen County. We always have a really good response when we come to Allen County, and you never, ever disappoint. So for the educators in this room, who are you? Raise your hands. And you're all wondering if you're going to have school tomorrow. So let's focus for a bit. So, and I will say I'm going to be like Dr. Yeager tomorrow and enjoy not making that difficult call, whether it comes in the morning or in the afternoon. So I'm not jealous of Dr. Hemsel for tomorrow, but I truly am happy to be here. For some of you who have heard our team present, some of this you're going to be like, yeah, we know that. You can never hear it enough. You can never see it enough. And we're going to continue to update your knowledge because it's extremely important that you know what's happening across the state. And again, like Dr. Hemsel said, we are who we vote for. We cannot say that enough. We are who we vote for. To the educators that are here, thank you, thank you, thank you. We cannot tell you enough for the work that you do every day on behalf of our students. We rely on you to be great. We rely on you to be amazing, and that is exactly who you are. To our retired teachers, thank you, thank you, thank you for considering to come back into education so I can take your applications tonight for the job fair that's going to happen. But for seriously, we appreciate your continued support. We cannot do it without you. So with that, we are jumping right into this slide, which we show everywhere we go. This is who we are.
The slide behind McCormick shows many numbers from Indiana K-12 education. There are 79,730 educators working in the state, serving 1.135 million students. 88.6% of them attend public schools, with 7.4% in non-public schools and 4% in voucher schools.
If we lose sight of this, we lose sight of our resources, we lose sight of our priorities, that simply cannot happen. I want to point out a couple of big items on here that are driving a lot of our current legislation, which, by the way, you got me out of the State House today, so thank you for that as well. But a couple of things on the left-hand side of who we are. That free and reduced number, since the time I stepped into office until today, continues to climb up. Now, it still is amazing to me to have conversation with our legislators who will sit and say, unemployment is low, are we sure that's right? Yes. Yes, when people are working for $10 an hour or $15 an hour, yes, that free and reduced number looks like it does for a reason. Go ask your schools. Go ask them what families look like. Go ask them the struggles that are real. Go ask them about the story. So that free and reduced number continues to climb, even though unemployment is extremely low. It totally is related to where we are in the state, what's happening to wages. It doesn't take me to come up here and say that. You can look at the data, but that free and reduced piece plays a significant role in what we're trying to do in those classrooms. The other piece is our languages. That number continues to go up. When I came into office, it was, I think, around 282. Now, obviously, we're at 296. Why do we track that? That, again, has opportunities, but some struggles for us. Those are the number of primary languages that are spoken across our state. And I will tell you, in areas like Allen County, that number is not so shocking, but you go with me into some of our rural areas, and they're like, is that right? Yes, that is right. And that brings its own dynamics into the classroom. The other piece of that, which I'm not telling, I was a special education teacher back in the day, which I would argue is one of the hardest jobs in our profession. But special education, if you are a special education teacher, who are you? Any? Bless you. Hard job. Special education numbers, we are watching those. Those continue to go up. Autism, not surprising, is the identification of students who are identified with autism. That number continues to grow. Why I bring that up? Because that is an area that we are woefully underfunded from the feds and from the state. So our needs way outweigh the actual monies that we are receiving in that arena. However, As public schools, we will not let off the gas on services. We do whatever we can do, and sometimes it looks miraculous based on the resources that we have. We are also very concerned because that's an area that we do not find teachers. We are struggling to find instructional aides. We are struggling to find the medical people who help us. We are struggling to find those behaviorists that we desperately need, and the list goes on. We always will watch that number, but that percentage is also continuing to grow. On a positive note, Dr. Hemsel also talked about grad rates. If you look on the right-hand side, we continue to watch our public schools hit over 90% again. We can have the conversation about the Exit 20, which is getting a lot of attention right now, which are students who are exited to homeschool. However, until the state of Indiana overall has accountability on homeschool, that's still going to continue to be a struggle. So, but our grad rate was over 90% for traditional public schools. If you look at our charter grad rates, which I know I'm kind of beat up on because people are like, you're picking on us, I am simply showing the number based on the definition Indiana has. I'm not making the number up. I'm not skewing that number. If they want to change the number, they need to change the definition or not have charter schools. It's super simple. So that's the number of 40%. And that is not something our team makes up. It is simply sharing the data based on how we define charters. So 40% is that number that's running pretty steadily as far as not really going up and down much, but so is the traditional number. So that 90% looks good. We obviously have room to grow in the charter arena. This one is concerning. We're watching what's happening in a time where we're saying we don't have enough resources. We are watching our capacity. The market can only withstand so much. That's the reality of it. So when you look at what is happening as far as from 2015 to 2020, what's happening with the number of schools that are going up and down in the number of districts. The one to note, the accredited non-pubs with the red V and the red number beside it, those are actually schools who are taking vouchers. So in 2020, out of the 342, 316 accepted vouchers. Remember, as a taxpayer, whether you agree or disagree with the Choice Scholarship Program, which are the vouchers, there is no oversight. So as a taxpayer, I cannot tell you where that money is going, what's happening to that money. I can tell you who receives it, but there's very little oversight on what's happening. I can tell you exactly what's happening to your money here. I can tell you exactly what's happening to any traditional public school in Allen County. But as far as vouchers, I cannot tell you that. I have people saying, did that pay for that football field? Did that go to teachers? No idea. Until the state decides that accountability is of importance, that is not going to be tracked. So we are watching the voucher numbers. The other increase would be the charter school numbers. So our charter school numbers are continuing to expand at 21% over the last 5 years. Now, the number of students in Indiana really is not increasing. But as you can see, the number of schools that are serving those students continues to increase. Where traditional public schools are being fiscally responsible and closing buildings as needed, we still have other buildings down the road popping up, or people will capture those school buildings and use them for other purposes. That goes back to, do we have enough resources to do what we're doing? If we are going to have choice as a state of Indiana, our legislators, if they're committed to choice, they have to be committed to funding it. And until that happens, we will continue to see what's happening in the state of Indiana with a lack of resources. So here are our numbers that we are continuing to watch. Interesting, there are some little things happening in legislation that we're going to talk about here shortly that will be impacting this. Student ethnicity groups, as a Department of Education, for at least the term that I'm in through 2020, we will continue to watch our special groups of students because, as you can see, we still have huge achievement gaps. And I am the first one to admit it. They are not easy to close. So someone who tells you that there's no reason for those gaps or that they're easy to address, have no idea what it's like in a school building or in a classroom. No idea. Do we need to continue to focus on it and work on it and send resources? Absolutely. But to beat people up simply because they feel like they're not trying is not fair. So I have been across the state. I've seen the efforts being made. Do we have room to grow? Absolutely. But the achievement gap is real. It still persists. But we also need to give resources to address it, which I would say we're woefully doing as a state. As a state of Indiana goes, outside of the department, it is not tracked. So we have the philosophy of our special groups need to be tracked, so we know how they're performing, we know where those resources need to grow. Our state accountability does not agree with that, so our legislators that are currently there, their philosophy is you put all the students in one pot and you follow the students in a cohort. That, to me, is a very dangerous practice because you don't know where those resources need to go. You really don't have a real firm grasp of what's happening. So we will continue at least through 2020 to say, you got to watch the groups. What happens when I leave office? Who knows? We'll see. There are two systems of accountability in Indiana. This is what I just talked about. One gives an A through F. That's your state accountability. Many of the educators in this room will tell you that is not worth a grain of salt. So I have walked into buildings that are A buildings that I'm like, oof, they got some room to grow. I have walked into buildings that are D's that I would be proud to send my child, since I won. But there are just differences in that A through F. It really is very dependent on socioeconomics for a big chunk of it, but also, too, the flexibility here that different schools have, it's not a one-size-fits-all measurement. So there are schools in Indiana that are only graded on certain items, and other schools have a lot more items they're graded on. So we're not even comparing apples to apples here. So that A through S system needs to be addressed. We have tried. We've presented multiple ways to try to get to a compromise with our state legislators, but right now they really like their A through F. They feel like parents can understand it. They feel like it's a direct representation of district or buildings and districts. I would argue it's not. So the A through S system is interesting. The S system, which is what the department's system is more of a leveling system. So it's not as punitive. It is reflective of the system, but it's saying we are all growing. We all have room to grow versus you are an F, and we're going to penalize you for the next 5 years. Because that's the A through F system. Whether we like it or not, that's the reality of it. For your information, I have really learned over the last 4 years that people do not have really working knowledge of what the department does. So here's a number that's going to stick with you. We are over half of the state budget. We are $8 billion. That's why people are in our business, because we're expensive. With title money, federal money, we're an additional $1 billion. So total budget for the Department of Education, only K-12, not higher education, we're $9 billion. So if you think for a second that they are going to love local control or they're going to stop passing mass amounts of legislation, that is not going to happen in Indiana. That is not going to happen because we're expensive and it's going to be very, very much controlled. So here's what we have at this point. What I think is going to happen, people say, what's 2020 going to look like? Right now we have the finance, the academics, and the technology, and everything that falls under that, which is a lot. However, once I'm out of office, when it becomes an appointment, I do foresee a lot of things combining, and we're going to show you what I think is going to happen based on what's happening now with some of the practices. So, before we get to that, Dr. Hemsel mentioned there is a big push right now, and I just got hammered in an article, I think it was IBJ, is that correct? So, don't read it, it's trash, but it was not by a reporter, it was by a gentleman who took offense to what I was saying about administration. Here's the reality. We do not make up numbers at the Department of Education. We pull numbers based on the data that is reported statewide and federal. We don't make it up. We also don't report things in a spin that benefits anyone. But when the idea came out from some people who did research, we called the researcher, like all of you would have done, to be professional and said, we think your numbers are off. The report you're giving is off. Well, that didn't go so well, but it was off. So we tried to explain why and that we were willing to work with that person and yada, yada. Well, that didn't go so well because that person was doing the report for specific reasons, and it was just flat out wrong. So we ran a dispute on it based on the numbers we have. Now, if the numbers are incorrect, it's because they're reported incorrectly from our local schools. And if that's the case, then you have a whole set of problems because their budget's on that and a lot of different reports are tied to it. So there's cross checks with that, from licensing to reporting, and there's multiple reports. So if it's wrong, you have a lot of wrong. So we were pretty confident. I mean, obviously there's always room for error, but we were pretty confident in those numbers. And we kind of did some trend comparison so that we felt really confident. When we looked at it, we came up with, people are saying that all this money is going to administrators. If you actually look what's happening, administrative and support staff our numbers have gone down 22%, which is not the story that's being told. The other piece of this that's not being told is the amount of K-12 bills that are in Title 20, which is our title for K-12. We have increased those. We are now, they're up for 2,222 mandates. So at a time where they're like, you know what, they're adding too many people. Well, you've added 2,222 mandates. Think about the enormity of that. And with those comes costs. They can say they don't, but they do. With them comes a need for people. With them becomes a need for support. So this is more of the story. Here's the other thing they don't want to tell you. In this report, which we tried to kind of give you a better snapshot of, the instructional coordinators that are up here have gone up 150%, but they're calling them administrators. So here's what happens. At Yorktown, where I was a superintendent, we had coaches. I did not label them as administrators because of their contracts. Other districts who have coaches do label them as administrators because of their coaches. So there is no consistent way to report some of the positions we have in Indiana. However, the report came out and lumped them all into administrators. That is not at all necessarily the situation. So you may be a coach and be basically a full-time in a teaching position, and you're not an administrative position, or you might be, depending on your district. So the instructional coaches, although have gone up, we also have watched when they went up. Well, when RISE came in, does everybody remember the year RISE came in? And we were like, holy cow. And the teachers were like, I got to set what? What are SLOs? And how do I do that? And how many observations are you going to have? And how long are you going to be in there? And the administrators, having been one of them, was like, how am I going to do that? So we had all kinds of conversations going on about time and about money and about how does that look. And we had a huge increase in those instructional coaches that were really help evaluators during that time in some of our districts. But the picture being painted is central offices went out and hired all these central office administrators. Now, I'm not saying that some aren't heavy in administration at central office, but I'll be honest, I've been across the state, and there are some that are super lean that I don't even know how they're operating. So we have kind of a mix. But when you're told that that is going up 31%, all the money's going to administrators, we need to make sure we're having an accurate picture, because the easiest thing to do from the State House, they are masterful at it, is to pit administrators against non-administrators, teachers against support staff, school boards against teachers, school boards against superintendents. It's easier to pit that blame so you don't have to come up with solutions. So we are watching what's happening with this conversation, but know the facts before we jump to conclusions. Again, you can look at your own local districts, but as a state, the rhetoric going around that administrators, that we're fat on administration and we keep adding, remember, we're actually down 22%. But when they talk about Indiana code, when you talk to your legislators, you need to remind them they have recently passed over 2,000 bills, K-12 alone. It's enormous, and we have more coming this session. Why do I bring up farmland assessment? That impacts your assessed valuation for schools, which is part of your funding. Why do I bring that up? Because for some of our areas in Indiana, that's a huge deal, and others, it's not such a big deal, but that's gone down for 5 straight years. That's kind of leveling out, so we'll see what that does. In this area, the impact in some of your school, in some of Allen County, has a bigger impact, obviously, than in other districts. But we are continuing to watch that because of the impact that it does have, which gets a little bit weedier, but something you just need to know. We're watching farmland assessed valuation. So you might have heard that we're solving the problem of our teacher pay with this teacher commission that the governor put in place. And I was like, why do we have to study something for over a year when we can have a 5-minute conversation and we can tell you what the problem is? Why? So that wasn't popular. But we have someone from the Department of Education who serves on the commission. We also have one superintendent who serves on the commission and one school CFO who serves on the commission. So we tried to say, you got to broaden that commission up. That was not well received, but it is what it is. So they finally ended up combining the actual commission with the advisory group. So now they're one, which I think is a good thing because you have more people who are kind of in the trenches that are having conversations with those who maybe aren't as familiar with school finance. Here are some of the things that they are talking about. My concern with this is, having been a superintendent, I remember my first year as superintendent, and guess what was talked about? All of this. So this isn't a new conversation. How many of you in here, your schools have clinics? You can go to your health clinic. How many of you, your districts, are watching prescription costs and have some specialized plan? Yep. So how many of you have had the conversation about merit pay? Anyone in this room having conversation about shared services? A lot of this up here, rainy day conversations, this isn't new for most of our superintendents and CFOs. It's not new conversation. But if we're still hovering in this area and no changes are happening, we have been saying our healthcare costs are out of control for a decade or more. And I'm sure even before that time. Those healthcare costs are crazy out of control for Indiana. Just read the RAND report and RAND 2.0 that came out. Shame on us that as a state, we can't get that in check. But you have to have a willingness from state leaders to get it in check. So the healthcare costs, until we get that piece figured out, which is really out of the authority of any superintendent and any school board, it is tough. It is tough because that cost is going like this. Some of our salaries are going like this. And so you have a mass gap problem. But here are the things that are being discussed. Our concern coming out of this as a team, like I said, not a whole lot of new ideas, and it's really boiling down to you have to fund it. At the end of the day, it has to be a priority, and you have to fund it. You have to set aside the veterinary barns. You have to pause on the swine barns. You have to wait a minute on some roads. You're going to have to prioritize differently. And until that willingness is there, we're going to continue to talk this to death. So I'm worried that there's a lot being put on that commission. I'm just concerned about what is coming out of that commission. So we'll be anxiously waiting that report, but here are some of the items that are being tossed around. The other piece of that, we've heard this for years and years as far as have them all go on the state plan. I'm gonna tell you right now, having come from a district with not a Cadillac plan, but a pretty good healthcare plan, to going on the state plan where I better stay healthy because it's really bad, that's not a great option. I mean, I'm living it. It's not a good option. It's expensive, and then your out-of-pocket costs are high. So where I keep hearing people say, well, we'll just have them go to the state plan. Hey, you know, guess who's not on our state plan? State legislators, because they get their own special plan. Huh. Guess who doesn't? This one. So I'm just telling you, when you hear that, you better pause and do your homework on what that plan looks like, because it's very different from most of our school plans. Even if you had a clinic, it's just very different. I mean, out-of-pocket costs are crazy. I had no idea the dentist could be so expensive. So teacher compensation, just something to pay attention to on the conversation that's happening.
The next part is backed by a slide that shows traditional public school fiscal loss.
When we have conversations about this slide, more times than not, I hear people talk about the circuit breaker loss, and that's a conversation. And then I hear people have a conversation about charter school loss, and that's a conversation. And then I have folks talk about school choice vouchers, and that's a separate conversation. And then we pop over and we talk about TIF districts, and we talk about tuition support reversions, and they're all separate conversations. Until we have one conversation about all of these pieces in totality, we are missing the boat. Now, here's what happens. They are not happy when you have this conversation in totality. Because when you look at some of these numbers alone, now these are just losses that are somewhat trackable, and we tried to be fair with it. So since 2009 to 19, 10 years, circuit breaker loss alone, $2.3 billion. You are not going to get that back. And there are some districts that get hammered and some that are like, what is that? Because they really aren't felt by it at all. So we have a huge difference in how that impacts districts. But $2.3 billion. You go to the charter school loss, $1.4 billion. These aren't separate dollars. These are coming out of the same K-12 pot of money. So when we tap, you know, pat ourselves on the back and say, look at this historical raise, really? Because we're having historical loss. So we got to make sure we're having the conversation where it needs to be. Choice scholarships were at $667 million, and that's in 7 years. So that also is getting expanded this session. So we're going to start losing more because more kids are be eligible. If you go up the TIF districts, that's a whole other conversation because that's a moving target, but I know it's really hitting some districts, the TIF issue. But the five-year tuition reversion, something that people don't realize, if the state of Indiana says, hey, look, we're given a 2% raise, yay, we're the best, and so they give us a 2% raise as far as totality of money, and let's say we distribute all that money, but the number of kids may not have been, as far as what we serve, may not have been to the level we thought, we revert that money that was in that pot back to the state of Indiana. So it's not like we keep it and start divvying it back up, or we hold on to it and put it toward TAG, or send it to our teachers, or do something with it that we really could do with it. We have to give it back. So in the last 5 years, you're talking, you know, $138 million. I'm thinking even if you, and last year we didn't have any reversion money, zero, because we tapped into all of it. But over the last 5 years, $138 million. And I have no authority, nor does the next person coming into my position have any authority to do anything but give it back. So that's an area that I'm like, why in the teacher compensation group talking about the reversion money? Why is it's touted as look at us, we're giving so much money to schools. They just don't say, and by the way, if there's extra, it comes back. So you're really not getting all the money that it looks like on paper in a budget per se. So it's kind of interesting to look at those numbers. So your next challenge, when you have a conversation with the legislator, you have to mention all these things. So memorize them right now. No, I'm teasing. So you have to have this conversation with all of them. There is a bit.ly on this PowerPoint. You are welcome to take it, use it, do whatever you want to do with it. It's information. It's your information. It's the state of Indiana's. I know this is a transition slide, but it's slow. Okay. Here's what we're trying to also keep in mind. Numbers that we're not super proud of right now, but they're not new numbers. Here's what we've been showing the state of Indiana legislators to remind them where we are. Again, when we go back to the State House, I hear a lot, and a lot of us were guilty of this. You know, we took a bill and we made a bad bill better. And that's become our message for the last decade plus. Like, that bill could have been a lot worse. Why are we taking that approach? That we're okay to make bad bills better and just live with them. We are who we vote for. We are who we vote for. So if we continue down the road where we know the people who are in office are going to continue to make our lives challenging as education, where are we? Where is that? I know we have over 30 teachers running for office. Anybody in here running for office? No, because they're busy out campaigning. So 30 teachers running for office. That is to be celebrated because that is a commitment that is tough to do. Absolutely. But this is not going to change if we are comfortable with making bad bills better. It is not, because that is an easy out for a lot of people. So 50 out of 50, 35 out of 50, wages have gone down 26% when you compare them to other experiences, 44th out of 50, 35 out of 50, and then the one that really should scare us all, I understood being a teacher, I understood as a mom, I understand as a wife, as an educator. If we have 35% of our teachers leaving in year 1 through 5, not leaving to go to another school, but leaving the profession, we are in trouble. We are in trouble on so many levels, on so many levels. I know it's a nightmare for your administrators who are trying to fill positions. I know it's a nightmare for your HR and your superintendents, but I'll tell you who it's a nightmare for, the teacher who's teaching beside them. Because when a good teacher walks out, you feel it every day. And not that you're not willing to help a new person coming in and get them up to speed, and sometimes that's a good thing. You know, you got new light in your life in your building, and you're like, they're awesome. But it takes a toll on everyone. And the cost associated with that turnover is extremely high to each district into the state of Indiana. To have a new person come in, to onboard them, and to exit someone is very, very costly. But that number should scare us. And when people stop by our office at the State House and say, hey, I want to share a story with you. And it happens all the time. They come in and say, I was a second year teacher. I love my job and I had to leave it. I hear it all the time. And it's hard because I understand what they're telling me, and it makes me sad for our kids and for our educators and for our state and for our communities. But I also, too, it's hard for me to defend, like, well, you know, you're going to make $35,000 for at least the next 10 years. And that's a hard conversation. Or, hey, you may get up to 40 if you hang in there. That is a tough, tough conversation when I'm watching grads from other areas come out and jumping right into jobs, and they're like, I make 43, and next year I'm going to make a 45, and they're just seeing movement, so which is good, but it's tough as an educator. So these are numbers that we are paying attention to and also adding to the conversation, but if we're settling for this, it's because we're settling. That's the bottom line. Oh, TIFFs. This is really hard to see. This came out not too long ago. Indiana's where the big yellow arrow is. That is our state's fiscal effort. So what happens is some really, really smart people outside of Indiana do an index calculation based on a lot of different things that we submit and the state submits. And then they come up and say, here are the states that are most committed to a fiscal effort to fund K-12. I don't know about you, but we're hovering down way below most of the states that you would even assume we would be below. But Indiana has obviously got a long way to grow, and this is the newest data. So when we have legislators saying, or community members sometimes will say, hey, you know what, you got enough. You're funded enough. Keep this in mind. So this is a nonpartisan type of index that's done every year, but this is where Indiana's hovering based on our last reports. So this is all of you. I wanted to bring this to, not all of you, because some of you may be out from outside of the county area, but we wanted to try to make this somewhat personal to all of you. We're looking at population changes, and we're also looking at student enrollment changes based on buildings. So green is good. That means your population's going up. But on the right-hand side, if you have green arrows, those are the number of buildings or districts where populations or enrollment's going up. And in the red, enrollment going down. And so you can see what's happening. Why do we show this? If we start losing population in certain areas, it completely impacts districts. We can show you the correlation. And remember, the money follows the child. So if you're losing population, or if you're losing and or enrollment, it's a tough battle right now. Because we have some districts that they're in areas where the population is exploding, their student enrollment is exploding, and they're doing okay fiscally. We have a lot of districts, about a third of them, that is completely the opposite. They're in areas where the population is declining, their enrollment's declining. However, they're hanging in there as far as offering services. Sometimes they're the only district in the county, so it becomes quite interesting. But this is all of you. But we are keeping an eye on that. We're also working with some of our economists across the state to help us better track and trend it, just because we're trying to project what's coming. The other thing that I think we're not having enough conversation about is the age of our buildings across Indiana. Our facilities are aging. Now, we're all not Hamilton Southeastern, where you walk in and they're all pretty nice new buildings. That's really, and you have a nice facility here, but I will tell you, across Indiana, our facilities are becoming a problem. And what's going to happen when that day comes sooner than later for a lot of our districts where you can't afford to put on another roof? That boiler is not going to make it, or you are in a situation where it's no longer considered safe. So there are a lot of conversations that I know outside of Indiana, people are watching Indiana to say, ooh, your buildings are hitting a point that's a huge concern. Go ask your superintendents. They know it. But they also know, too, to pass a referendum, to do anything about it, or to get a GO bond or whatever the case may be to get that building where it needs to be, can be quite difficult. You've got debt issues, you've got community concerns, you've got wage concerns, you've got assessed valuation concerns, a lot of pieces to that as far as if it's just that easy to address it. So buildings and facilities, huge concern across Indiana. This is the fiscal impact of vouchers. Try it again to make it personal. So the voucher impact loss, you have Phil Downs in your area who is the voucher king, who is relentless in looking at the data, presenting the data, and making people upset. So he has done a good job, and he's not forming an opinion. He is simply educating people. He's simply going out and showing these numbers, and then people get upset. I'm like, if you're upset with the numbers, then you got to fix your policies, because that's what's happening. So your voucher losses, you can see just by district for some of the counties, I run into a lot of people. And usually, sometimes in small districts, it's some retired folks that will have me in, and they're like, we don't have any kids that get those vouchers. That doesn't impact us. And I'm like, yes, it does. It impacts every single district. It depends on the level of impact. You may not lose a single student who actually takes a voucher, because it comes out of the same pot of money, we all lose. You all lose money to vouchers. Now, again, agree, disagree, you have a lot of private schools in this area with a lot of kids using vouchers. And people will say that brings money into the economy. I'm not going to dispute some of that. Here's what I am telling you. You can't dispute these numbers either. So there is a loss to public schools. There's no doubt about that. What's happening legislatively? Don't shoot the messenger. So here's where we're at today, and this could change tonight. It could change right now. It could change tomorrow. So this is the best I got for you right now. Here's some biggies that we're paying attention to. Firearms, interesting conversation this session about who can carry firearms on a campus. And so before, it was if your school board said, yes, you can carry, and you have to identify who's carrying and what that training looks like, you can do that. Two districts have taken advantage of that, and one actually is actually implementing. So for various reasons. But not very many of our districts said, yeah, we want all of our teachers packing, good luck. That's not really how that went down. Although we could, which I'm not suggesting that's a good idea. But the firearms in buildings, now there is something coming out to say, if you are a retired law enforcement officer, there's different layers of who it can be. Someone who has been trained in firearms and you are carrying, you're going to need to identify yourself at an event, and then you can carry. Here's my concern with that. Having been a superintendent, having been a principal, it is a little chaotic at a football game. It's a little chaotic at any event, like a school play or whatever. It's a little busy. I have to rely on someone coming up to me to say, hey, I'm self-disclosing, I'm carrying, and here's why I'm carrying, and here's my credentials. Good luck in some of our areas that that's going to happen. And what's going to happen is we're going to have someone come to me and say, hey, there's a man over there with a gun. Then I got to go track it over there to say, do I need to bring the policeman with me? Is it that type of situation? Or is he allowed to? And we just got to figure this out. That is a hard situation to put anybody who's supervising an event in my opinion. But that's a firearm piece. Vaping, obviously, they're looking at raising the age of students who vape. However, no penalty if they do get caught, which is a whole other conversation. We have a huge crisis with vaping. We had a school down south last week where there were 14 kids in the hospital from the same grade who got a hold of some really bad stuff. But that's not stopping. We get calls all the time. The Department of Health and the Department of Education, we are so busy. And I know teachers, you are trying to keep up with it. Administrators are like, I can't catch them. I know they're doing it. It's really hard. It's a problem. It is a huge problem. I've had people tell me we're now using our wands to try to see if we can figure out the pieces of metal in it to catch kids. And it's a problem. So beyond the health issue, it's just disruptive. So we have a lot of layers to the vaping, but that there are pieces going through. The funding piece, I'm going to bring up a couple things, and they're on pause. So disannexation, this is interesting. What they are proposing, which is on pause, so today was on pause. They were taking South Bend, and South Bend had an area in within the South Bend school system that another school system was serving their kids. So the kids had already made the choice to go over to this other district, like a little swath of them. That school system, which was receiving those kids and getting ADM from them, decided, hey, we kind of want the property tax money. So this bill would have allowed that school system who was receiving those kids to go after that whole swath of property tax. Now, I will tell you, if that starts happening across the state of Indiana, where one district decides they want only certain parts, like, I like these houses and these kids and they're high-performing and I don't want these. I want these. That's what this bill would allow to do. So it was piloted in South Bend. However, we know what that means. How do you pilot something like that? You either take them or you don't. Plus, we understood what was going to happen in the years to come. Now, that has been on pause for right now because there's a lot of segregation issues with what's happening with that bill. And so we're watching it closely. But I'm just saying, if we get to the point where a district can decide, hey, I'm opening enrollment, I'm taking your kids, that's one thing. But I'm also doing that, and I'm taking all of your property tax dollars, knowing you still have to service what you've got, how in the world do you budget with that? Because if Green decides they want a part of South Bend, and now Penn Harris Madison wants a part of South Bend, and someone else wants a part of South Bend, and there's not a darn thing in the law that the South Bend people can do, that's a problem. So it's very interesting how that's being played out. It's on, like I said, it didn't get called up, but it's supposedly Monday may have something. So we're keeping an eye on that. Also, deficit financing is how your schools run and how that definition is defined. I'm very worried about maybe not this session, but next session, what that looks like if they change the definition. So they're trying to get creative with dollars. So they're like, we're going to start defining things differently. I will tell you, there are a lot of new superintendents, a lot of new CFOs, a lot of new school boards that are knowing what's happening with their finances, that when you say we're going to redefine deficit financing, it should cause everybody a big pause. But I think it's coming, whether it's this session or next. Another piece that's quite interesting is lead testing. Every school, every district, be required to lead test. Clearly, I'm not going to be the state superintendent that says, I think that's a bad idea, because we want the safety and security of kids. However, superintendent hat, here's what my concern is. I know some of our schools are going to have tests that come back problematic, and that's exactly what it's meant to do, so you catch that and you can address it. That, having been around schools that have had to address it, is super expensive. So all I said is, fine, great. What a great bill. Let's make sure the kids are healthy with the water testing. You better have some fiscal set aside to pay for the fix, because it is not going to be cheap. And depending on what that threshold looks like for lead, and again, we want the kids to be safe, but we have to make sure the schools have resources to address it. So that's the piece that's not being considered. Like, well, they can afford it. Really? I mean, okay. So it's one of those situations that's the biggest concern with the lead testing. One of the academic rigor pieces that I've been very concerned, I know when Dr. Yeager was on the board, he was concerned of this as well. We want opportunity for students. We're all about access and opportunity, and all of you are too. You want the best for kids. One of the bills that's going through would have said, if you are a junior in high school or a senior and you have got one credit, so you showed up and you were breathing and got enough for one credit, which is not a good day, but you've got one credit. That could be PE, that could be calculus, which probably not if you've got one credit, but it could be a lot of different things. One credit, it could be English 9, it could be biology 1, one credit. And you pass a couple different tests, you will be eligible for a high school diploma. Just like your peers who have 40 credits, passed all the graduation requirements, and got a diploma. I think that sends a horrible, horrible message, because what is the incentive for the kid to ever get more than one credit? And we have kids that'd be like, score, I'm waiting this thing out. I'm gonna get my credit, I'm gonna take the test. The other part of that that we tried to tell the legislators is, do you not think that's setting the kids up? Because if you have one credit, what's the likelihood you're going to blow those tests out of the water? Probably not high, unless you just have a kid who's super, super talented and just is struggling to enjoy school or just doesn't attend. And we have some, but I would say the majority of our students who have one credit would struggle on many of our highly qualifying exams. They just would. So that's going through as a pilot for two of our districts in Indianapolis. I cannot get behind that. And there are some high school principals like, sign us up now. And I get it. I do. I just think that sends a horrible message as a state to say, all we need from you is one credit. Then what's the point? If all you need is one, and you can pass a couple tests. So interesting things that are happening. Hold harmless is probably going to go through, which is what we were after with the Red for Ed. So good for all of you who showed up. PGP points, that flexibility looks like it's coming back. The reading testing has been an interesting bill. This is a bill that would allow all 3 through 8 and 10 to have everything on iLearn read to them if they were identified as students with special needs. Here's the problem. My special ed teachers will get this, and all of you will, but my special ed teachers especially, because you live the adaptations and modifications and all that stuff. So we made the point, if everything's read to them, it's a listening comprehension test. It's no longer just a reading comprehension test. So we had experts from around the world, around the nation, who were saying, yes, you're really messing with some things here. If that would have gone through, they were like, here's what you're going to do. You're going to redo iLearn 3 through 8. I'm like, we just started iLearn, and we're going to redo it. Okay, you could tell the field that. So iLearn would have to be redone. We'd have to redo standards. Again, go tell the field that. And iRead 3, we would have to redo because 30% of it's on reading comprehension. So we would have to redo a lot of assessments and standards in 2 years at the tune of a minimum of $10 million. We're like, probably not a good idea. Just saying. So we had a lot of conversations about that. Finally, in the end, as of yesterday, it came that it would send it to a commission to study, which we do that a lot in Indiana, a commission to study, and we would just give it a pause and let some things play, not knowing where all this is going to go. So just know there's something, I mean, something will happen probably next session, but it's not going to be cheap, and it's going to be interesting, because I know people are test fatigued on assessments. We've given so many different assessments, and you don't have a lot of trend data. I get it. We're also watching the conversation happening with formative assessments, because that's not been super positive right now. As far as we have a lot of districts that like their formative tests, your NWAs, your AIMS, your AIRS, depending on what you're using, people say that's the one we put the most credibility. It's our MTSS. We have high ability identification. We use it for, you know, a triangulation of data. We use it usually. Something's going to happen with that as well, because our General Assembly is not liking NWA right now. So we're kind of cautioning our NWA schools that, hey, that ship might have sailed as of probably in a year or so. So something's happening with that. They just are not NWA fans. I know Dr. Hemsel touched on this, just bringing this to light, because, again, the conversations that are happening across the state as far as have one credit, we're good, just get one credit. This kind of plays to this. In Indiana, you just have to know, relative to the United States, Indiana is heavy in jobs that are available on to the right, less than a high school diploma and high school. Those are the jobs that are being filled. Now, as a state, you cannot sustain that. You cannot. You can on a lot of levels, but less than a high school diploma or just a high school diploma. If you go on this side, you can see across the nation, the job growth is an associate or higher. Sometimes that's credentialing. If you get into the trades, different credentials, or a bachelor's and higher. So we're paying attention to what's happening with jobs in Indiana versus what's happening to jobs across the nation. And our economists are saying we're in trouble. You wait about 5 or 10 years and people be like, huh, I wonder what happened. This is what happened. So we're watching this. We're sharing this data for you. Just so you know, when the conversations are happening about courses that are available, what's count as a diploma, are we just filling the workforce for tomorrow or for the next 4 years after they get out of high school? Are we worried about the next 4 decades? That should cause us all to pause, because this is what's happening. This is our current governance structure. It is going to change once I leave office. I show you this so you are educated on what this looks like. So in Indiana, right now I'm the blue circle. The rest of the yellow really belongs to the governor's office, the governor and the executive branch. So the Commission of Higher Ed, the Department of Workforce Development, the Governor's Workforce Cabinet, and the State Board of Education are pretty much the governor's babies. There are a couple of the members that aren't with the governor, but for the most part, it's the governor's board. So this is what it looks like now. The reason why I show you this is because what we're going to look like in 2020, past 2020, based on the new law that my position becomes appointed, all of the yellow will fall in the governor's office. Now, it's us and one other state that's going to look like this, because most states have people's voice somewhere, whether it's the state superintendent's office or whether it's the state board of education is elected, or the state superintendent is confirmed by senators who are elected. There's some avenue to get the people's voice in over half of the state budget. That is not the way this is designed. It is all control in one office. And I don't care who he or she is. I don't care what their party affiliation is. This is a lot of power for one person and one office. So the only reason, again, I share this to you, so you are an educated person, you understand how this is not the norm, because it's being painted as this is just how it is across the nation. That's not true. That is not true. So paying attention to this. The other piece that is so interesting to me is we keep layering up. So at a time where we're like, we got to save our pennies, there's not enough money for educators, there's not enough money for X, Y, healthcare costs, there's not enough, we could just start layering it up. We keep adding layers of governance. That slows things down, and it's expensive, but we just keep layering up. I encourage you, been across the state, continue to be a voice. There's a lot of ways to do that, whether you are emailing, calling, coming to things like tonight, sharing with your friends, sharing PowerPoints with people, continue to be a voice. The only way we're going to make change in Indiana K-12 is to inform people, and it takes effort. So I know some of you are interesting where you're like, I'm never running for office. I'm out. You lady, you're crazy. Okay, but can you talk to your General Assembly member? Can you contact the governor's office? They represent you. We put them into office. They are working for you. It's your state house. It's your chamber. They are representing you. But what are we doing with that? I would encourage you to stay informed, stay engaged. If you need help with this, and again, I don't care your political affiliation. I do not care. If you need help with what does this look like, we are willing to help people. We've had people call and say, I'm not sure how to get to my General Assembly person because they won't return a call and they won't email me. I'm like, oh, no. We'll get you there. So you let us know what you need, because we represent, at the State House, we represent you. I'm not sure time-wise. We have time for questions? Dr. Hemsel says yes. Yeah.
Teachers are praying every day that someone doesn't shoot them in their classroom. They're praying for pay. We have prayer in the schools. And I'm sure some of you in here, I think this is a choir, pray every day that we have more of a focus on these issues. What I hear about is prayer in schools, and can teachers be allowed to carry guns, which I totally abhor that myself, having been a former educator, and I often said if they asked me to carry a gun, I leave. So thank you for bringing the whole picture before us. Another issue I think we have is that people can walk in and say, I want to vote a Republican ticket. I want to vote a Democratic ticket. That means stop thinking, folks. Listen to those people who tell us they're doing things for us when they really aren't. Thank you.
I appreciate your comment. One thing I will say, you brought up several pieces that are moving for educators. If a legislator asks you, which they do, what do you want us to do? Sometimes the local legislators, the people who represent you, will say, what do you expect me to do? What do you want me to do? You know an easy answer right now? Stop passing laws. Just give us a minute. 2,200 new laws in the past few years, really? And they wonder why we're losing people and we can't keep our head above water and we can't keep our finances. And take a pause. Sometimes, I know this is no surprise to the educators, so we don't know what's working, what's not working, because we keep changing everything. Take a minute. Let us see what's working, what's not working. I will tell you, that poster conversation has spent so much time, and it came back up again this week. We already have American flags in our rooms. We already allow prayer in our classrooms. That is a national push. for that particular poster to come up, and it has to be exactly the way they want it. Now, there is no accident in that. That's not by chance that that's coming up again. So there are just so many things that are pushes from a national organization, national level, that Indiana hooks onto, and by golly, this person has five things, this person has three things, this person has six things. They all have their personal agendas to get through, and at the end of the day, we're staring at 2,200 new laws just for K-12. I mean, they just need to take a minute. So I encourage you to share with your legislators, just take your foot off the accelerator for a minute. Just pause. But I appreciate your comments. There are a lot of moving personal agendas right now at the State House.
Okay, Dr. Hems said that you were, described you as a hero, and you really are my hero. But I just still don't understand this virtual charter school. 2 years ago, Indiana Chalkbeat reported that this money was, that these children weren't really enrolled in the school, and quite honestly, some of the local legislators are blaming you.
Yeah.
So could you tell us a little bit more about how this happens?
I can. So she's right. I mean, it's the Department of Education, and I will take that obviously as the leader of the department, that's getting blamed for the virtual charter issue. Here's what I will say. A lot of that blame is really looking, instead of finding solutions, I say it's still causing confusion. And so when the confusion is there, it helps mask. We're not going to look for solutions. We signaled through every legislative session our concerns, put it in legislative priority, sent briefs, communicated to everyone that we possibly could communicate to, red flags, problem, problem, problem. If you think back to a couple years ago, the State Board of Education even shut down the largest virtual charter because of a lot of concerns, but those students just transferred to other large charters. So here's what happens. The Department of Education gets the data that is submitted from all schools, including virtual charters, in assurances. So students have to have a number attached to them that can't be a number in another district. We look at those conflicts. We run 70 at the department, 70 different cross checks on that data. So we don't just get it and go, okay. We run 70 different cross checks. If someone's trying to break the law, it is really difficult to stop them if you have policy that's loose. So everything within our authority, we did. We ran the cross checks, we did everything in our authority. We also, under my term, every single time those came in, we looked at a signature of assurance with your, which your principals already do and your superintendents already do, and submit to us. But even if they didn't sign that, which they didn't in the past, we wouldn't have had any authority to do anything anyway. So we kept telling people, you got to put some teeth on this. Now, during our term, they signed it. Now, if you sign it as a superintendent and you're being dishonest, it's tough to catch unless there's a conflict of the student. But if the conflicts are kids that have dropped out and they're nowhere else, they're not in another school, they're deceased or whatever, we don't have, they're still on our books as students of Indiana. So the system has a lot of areas for growth. But as a department, I will stand by, we did everything under our control, including signaling to everyone who would listen, we have major concerns. This week, finally, they came to us and said, it was 2:30, and they said, you have till 4 o'clock to give us your ideas on how to fix this. Really? So luckily, we have for 2.5 years been providing ideas. So we pulled those ideas back up and sent them on to the powers to be. We also introduced bills last year that got defeated to fix the problem. So we tried to be good partners with that. We tried everything in our authority, but I will tell you, I've heard the department being blamed. I've heard the State Board of Accounts being blamed. I've heard everybody taking the blame, and I'll take some hits as far as, do we have room to improve our system? Yes, and we've offered those solutions, but we need some authority that requires statute. We just have to. So we as a department took that personal and said, we have got to internalize this and review our practices. Where can we improve? We came up with ideas. We submitted them as far as this is where we need legislative help. You have to have legislation passed to have that done. The other piece of it, if I'm a traditional public school, most of us are under State Board of Accounts. So when the State Board of Accounts comes in, they look at our enrollment trends. They are also scrutinizing that because we have to give them all of our signed off State Board of Accounts enrollment sheets. I mean, they're not State Board of Accounts, but enrollment sheets that the State Board will look at. Charters are not required to be under State Board of Accounts, which is another layer of accountability that needs to be in place. But I can't tell them to do that. I mean, I don't have that authority, and I'm not trying to pass the buck. I'd love to have that authority. Someone's got to give it to me. So they're not required to do that. So you have an independent person coming in, whoever they choose, to do their audits. So there are so many pieces to this that are painted as a simple, let's blame the department, which is unwarranted, it's inaccurate, but it's an easy scapegoat if someone doesn't want to solve the problem. So are we looking for solutions? Are we looking to blame? So we have offered, let's sit down, let's figure this out, pay attention, because as of yesterday, before the 2:30 to 4 o'clock, we'd not even been asked. Now, the Dems have been asking forever, but we've provided them with bills, and it's tough to get them through. They've been asking for years. Give us what's going to fix it, and we've been providing it. It just doesn't have a chance. But we have offered, and we've offered, and we've offered. So there's a lot, I hate to say blame, there's a lot of responsibility to pass around. It's a lot of money. The other piece of it is the way Indiana is set up, the authorizer, who is Delville at this point, simply does not have as much access to an operator as you would think, but that's statute. So Indiana could say, hey, authorizer, you have access to everything, or you're co-responsible, you have to sign off. I mean, there are things that could take place that would have avoided that or at least made a difference, but you have to have statutory authority over it. So I know. I mean, I understand why I'm getting blamed for the whole piece of it. I will defend our team and, I mean, our department all day long based on what we did with our authority. But 70 cross-checks is not small. But if you're going to break the law and the system has so many loopholes, that's what happens. And there's still a lot of investigation going on, so we don't know the entire story yet. And we're being good partners with the investigation, but it's messy. It's a messy situation.
Dr. McCormick, thank you again for coming down and sharing all this Absolutely. Information with us. When you talk about, you know, we have fallen behind financially with the fiscal revenues because we're not part of, I guess, the percentage of the GDP as opposed to the percentage of the overall budget, what would be, because next year is a budget year, what should we be asking for? Because if we just go down and say we need more and the teachers need to be paid more, they're going to say, we've given you more. So what would be a reasonable amount that would actually move the needle for us that we should be able to afford as a state if we're really committed to our children and our schools?
Yeah. So step one, separate line item for charters, step one. Step two, separate line item for vouchers. Then as far as the funding formula, if we went 3%, it would be significant if you lined item the other entities. So if charter was line item, voucher was line item, and you gave 3% on the school budget, no reversions, it would be a good step. Do I think that's gonna happen? No. Not under the current leadership. I don't, but I think there are solutions. It's a matter of you have to prioritize it. I honestly think, too, it's a time for us to say we have to pause. How much choice is needed? How many choices in a market is really needed for a child? There are some kids that have 10 choices around them, and they're all pretty darn good. There are other kids that have no choices around them, and sometimes it's not great. So we're not even consistent with it. But if we would just take a minute to, now we've been at it for about a decade, to pause and study choice and say, what can our market in Indiana handle since our number of children are not really growing? What would that look like? Well, if you put a simple pause on that, that too would have an impact, but you have to give the increase along with it. We have been in environments where we have to go in to our, when anytime a new building opens up, it's more expense for the state. Anytime a new school opens or whatever the case may be, we have gone into those environments, and I will tell you, if we don't get a handle on quality choice or at least pause it, there are some environments that you wouldn't even believe the stories I could tell you. You wouldn't believe them. But when it's the wild, wild west of choice and no quality control, it impacts the fiscal, it impacts the quality of education, because guess what? Those kids are very mobile. They're going in and out of schools. And that's a situation. But line iteming those, giving an increase, and putting a pause on the line items would be a good first step.
Yeah, Dr. McCormick, thanks very much for this lecture. I've learned a lot, and your passion is evident, and I appreciate that. And all the teachers here, my three kids went to Carroll, but I also went to St. Paul Lutheran and then Concordia Lutheran. And one of the things that you said was concerning vouchers and why I really don't want your supervision is you said that schools that do not follow the LGBT agenda or the radical social left agenda should not receive vouchers. And I thought, I mean, that's a very, and then you even labeled us like this was a bigoted old way, this was the way of old people's thinking. According to that, you know, not even Jesus or St. Paul could be a teacher or receive a voucher. And all we care about, when you look at these kids, how many of our kids are in broken homes? And all we're saying is we want families, and we think fatherhood and motherhood should be honored. And I think that's the kind of, you call it the Wild West of school choice. I call it, you know, no monopoly is ever going to be successful. It's okay to have FedEx. It's okay to have UPS. And it is our tax money, too. So I mean, I'm all for everything that you do in public schools, but I'm also concerned about Jennifer McWilliams, who was fired because she was part of Purple for Parents, and they didn't like somebody speaking up against Red for Ed, which, again, I think all of these things are pretty great. And I'm worried about John Klug, who's a teacher in Brownsburg, who was fired even though he tried to accommodate and say, I'll call everybody by their last names, but he's concerned about kids. So. When you look at the top down and you look at the NEA, which is taken over by radical left, I mean, they're for pro-abortion. They give money to abortion. Well, yes, they do.
So here's what I will say. Let me address a couple things.
Okay.
So I respect your comments.
Thank you.
I respect, there are a lot of private schools in Indiana that do a really, really good job. But I'm also worried about the 1 in 5 LGBTQ students who are identified who have contemplated suicide. I'm very concerned about we're the third ranked highest in suicide attempts for youth as defined. I'm worried about the message it sends of some of those kids who have said, do you know we can be excluded? Or some of those adults who have said in admissions we're excluded. If we want to have schools that say we're excluding by admissions, there are some schools that say we are going to do that and we don't want your taxpayer dollars. And you won't hear a word from me. If you're not taking taxpayer money, and if that's not that I necessarily personally agree with it, but I'm not going to get in anybody's business. I just wouldn't. But if you're taking taxpayer money, there should be some accountability to taxpayers. And LGBTQ families also pay taxes. And if anybody's welcome except for this group, or this group, or this group. That's not what public tax dollars are meant to be used for, in my opinion. And I know we'll have a difference of opinion. Here's the other piece of that. What I see happening with choice, as far as vouchers, it was touted as, let's get kids who are in low, and I've heard it from everybody who even started the program, low performing schools who are black and brown students who are most at risk into really good education environments. Fast forward to today, it is without a doubt the highest growing population are white, suburban, with incomes higher than $75,000. The last time I looked, that wasn't black and brown, it wasn't at-risk students, and it wasn't students of poverty, and many of them now have never stepped foot in a public school. So it wasn't like they attended it earlier when Mitch Daniels put it into place that I had to go 2 years in a failing school and then a way out. So the intent of the program has really morphed over the years. The number of dollars has really flowed differently over the years. Like I said, if it's public taxpayer money, I find no reason why there cannot be accountability fiscally, academically, and with admissions that the same schools who also take public dollars are held to. It's just if you're going to take them, if you're going to take that taxpayer dollar, I think there should be some threshold that you have to meet. And I know we'll have a difference of opinion. 100%. But not all of that is your money. So one voucher was not your entire taxpayer. There were a lot of taxpayers that paid into that. So what if it was an LGBTQ taxpayer dollar as well? It's their tax dollar as well. Why can't they come to your school? So, I mean, I know it's just a philosophical difference, but and it's just a, really an opinion at this point and a philosophy, but I really feel strongly of if you take taxpayer dollars, you need to be held to the same standards, and your admission policy should mirror the admission policy of public schools, and that is we can't shut our doors.
Higher after they get their surgery. And now we're in a situation where kids are getting puberty blockers, which is abhorrent. How can we do this? How is that medically sound to young kids? And then we're giving them hormone treatment. If kids who are confused are allowed to grow up and just be left to discover who they are, 90% of them will become comfortable in their own bodies. 90%. But if you get them on this regimen early on, which is encouraged now, then they will almost always transition towards surgery. And now we're getting to the point where many are post-surgery and finding out they made a big mistake, because instead of helping them get to the source of their problems, we go too quickly into medicalizing it in a way that can never be reversed. And this is not the time for it. I really appreciate you being here. But I'd like everybody to know that I'm very concerned about these kids, too. Thank you.
I am, too. And I think it's such a personal decision that I think that decision is better left to the individual and their family who knows best what's best for them. So truly, before I leave, I know the weather's getting dicey and people are going to try to get out. But I truly, truly want to thank all of you for support for the students of Indiana. I also, especially the teachers, again, thank you for all you do. Continue to be a voice. Continue to do what you do. Continue to stay focused on students. So thank you very much.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Northwest Allen County Schools for organizing this event. And special thanks to Christopher Himsel, Lizette Downey, and Steve Pearson for facilitating our recording. This entire program is available online at WBOI.org or wherever podcasts are found. Our music is by Mark Waldick, Noah Campodonico, and Kurt Remke. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Our production assistants are Monica Blankenship and Michaela Velton. Until next time, thank you for listening. From WBOI Fort Wayne.